Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law, with Denise Howell, Episode 39, Social Lubricants and Frictions.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiT. And by the new Ford Sync, featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation. All voice-activated from Ford Sync. For more details and to enter to win a free Nano or Zune, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Hi, and welcome to This Week in Law, Episode 39. I'm Denise Howell. Thanks so much for joining our show. We're here this week with a special guest, Rick Clough, who's on the blogger team at Google.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I'm doing great. We're really glad to have you on because Google had a big announcement this week that we're going to get to in just a second, right as I welcome and introduce Colette Vogel. Welcome back, Colette.
Hi, Denise. Great to be here. Thanks.
Hi, great to have you back. And Ernie Svensson is with us too. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, Denise. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. So, Rick, let's get right into it. I'm so excited about this. Tell us what you've been up to at Google and what Google has unleashed on the world of people interested in legal issues.
Well, hopefully it's not unleashed, more like just a happy little event that happened on Tuesday. So for anybody that didn't hear, we added some new content to Google Scholar. I think I unofficially leaked it Monday night on Twitter, but then the blog post went up Tuesday morning. We got some case law into Google Scholar, and what this means is that federal cases from 1924 to the present and state cases from 1950 to the present are now fully searchable in Google Scholar. That includes the full text of the opinions, the footnotes, the page numbers, the page breaks. And in each opinion itself, the citations within the cases are hyperlinked so that if you're reading one opinion, you can navigate from that opinion to the next. And every opinion also has a tab that shows you how it was cited so that you can see other opinions pointing into the opinion and how they quoted that opinion so that it starts to make each opinion itself much more readable for the average citizen who's not a practitioner. They get to understand really what this opinion means in the broader context of other opinions that have been written out there. So really fun project, something that was something I was giving my 20% time to. Anybody that doesn't understand what that is, I'm happy to explain that in more detail. But there were a number of engineers who made this happen. I was just part of the team that have been contributing at various times over the last couple of years to getting this out. And it's really exciting to have it be live and so far, at least the feedback I've been seeing has been very, very positive.
Yeah, that's what I've been seeing too, except for the one sort of semi-snarky comment I saw on Twitter from someone saying, well, pity the poor lawyers who are about to get WebMD'd by everyone who's thinking that they can now be their own lawyer because Google has presented this wonderful resource, which I don't really think there's a danger of.
Well, I did see that comment, and while I think that there may be some risk to that dynamic, I think overall this isn't intended to make it easy for people to practice law themselves. I think it's more about helping people understand what these laws are. Historically, I was talking to my mom Tuesday night who was trying to understand, well, two things. One, what this had to do with my job on Blogger. And it was very hard to explain to her that it has nothing to do with my job on Blogger. And then two was to help her understand, look, there are all of these laws that do govern our lives that historically she and others who are not practitioners have never really had access to. And now they do. So hopefully it makes them perhaps a more informed client if there's a need to be engaged with a lawyer. But I think more than that, it's simply about being a better, smarter citizen and understanding what these things are and how they apply.
I think it's just terrifically cool. I love the way that it has the links to the cited cases and the links that have cases that have cited the case. Now, for people who aren't lawyers, we're getting sort of deep into how law is practiced and presented to the courts. But courts care a great deal about the weight that cases have as they go down time and get considered by other courts. And there is a service called Shepherds that has historically, I mean, goodness knows for how many years, provided the references that courts like to look at and see, well, how this case has been discussed and applied and treated, etc. So it seems like the database that you've set up, Rick, is supplying some of that service. And I'm wondering a few things. I'm wondering how you came up with the universe of case law that's going to be included. And also tell me more about the Shepherds-esque aspect of it.
Sure. So to the first question, the answer is very simple. We acquired a collection of content and aim to have it be a comprehensive collection. So our goal would be, and to the extent that it's not already, certainly to make it so, a complete collection of cases from 1924 to the present for federal, district and appellate courts, as well as tax and bankruptcy. On the state side, it's 1950 forward. One of my favorite interactions I've had over the last couple of days was one of my law professors at University of Richmond who reached out and said, well, why aren't all the Virginia opinions in here? They should be. And I said, well, I agree. But if you go to the Virginia Supreme Court's website, the only opinions they have online go back to 1995. So what we've just done is dialed that back to 1950, but he responded right away and copied me on a thread to the head of IT for the Virginia Supreme Court saying, well, it should be everything. And I said, well, I would love it to be, but I'm not aware of any collection. Well, just this morning, I got an email back from the person at the Virginia Supreme Court saying, you know what? Back in 1974, we moved all of these to tape, and we have all these cases back to 1924. And I just found the guy who knows where the tapes are. We'll copy those to CD for you, and we'll ship it to you. So the hope here is that as more courts recognize that there's a facility with which citizens can get access to this content, we'll have more of these outreaches just happen. And so it won't just be Virginia because I happen to go to law school in Richmond, Virginia. It will be every state that will say, well, gee, we could do that too. And wouldn't it be great if it went back to the first opinion instead of this semi-arbitrary cutoff of 1950? So I think, again, back to your first question, the hope would simply be that it's as complete as we can make it, and hopefully it will expand over time. As to the second, you know, this is, again, an important thing. I know a lot of the commentary, particularly from law students and from practitioners, has been about shepherdizing or keynotes or other things that exist at the for-pay services that provide excellent content and value in those services. We're not really trying to build a service to serve the need of the lawyer who needs to go through the process of shepherdizing that case. Certainly an individual citizen who wants to know whether Planned Parenthood v. Casey is still good law can look through and see, here are the cases that have cited to Planned Parenthood v. Casey. The How Cited tab shows you, here are the quotes that those judges use to describe their citation of Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And then that will help inform you as an interested individual whether or not it's still good law. We're not intending this to be a practitioner's tool. And I think for right now, our goal would be to be responsive to the needs of citizens who want access to this information and want to better understand it. But certainly to the extent that you're filing briefs or you're arguing cases, this is not going to be a replacement for services you've used historically.
Don't you think that's somewhat inevitable, that if it's free and easy to use, that the frictionless nature of it will begin to have it substitute for the way that lawyers have traditionally looked up and used and cited law to courts, and the way courts have used law too?
Well, I think to the extent that there's any shift in how lawyers practice today and what our announcement on Tuesday does, I think my favorite one was where there was a pro bono lawyer who said, my pro bono service, the quality of practice that I'm able to give to my pro bono clients just got a lot better, because pro bono lawyers are sort of hamstrung. Depending on if they're in a big firm, they're going to have access to tools and services that they might not otherwise have. But particularly if they're solo lawyers doing pro bono work or within nonprofits who may not have the same tools at their disposal, that this at least gives them access to a comprehensive collection of content that they may not have had access to before. So will that improve the quality of their pro bono service? Hopefully, yes, and that would make me very proud if that was a byproduct. What we might see down the road, boy, I don't know. I think Google's general approach to stuff like this is, let's identify the specific need, and in this case it was, our mission is to organize the world's information, make it accessible, make it useful. We think this is a pretty pure application of delivering on that mission. Will others try and build up around this and add functionality? Probably yes, and that would be great. But I think we're not going to seek to be the complete replacement or swap out for some of these more professional, more value-added services. I just don't see that being our mission or our goal ultimately with either this collection of content or that business need.
Colette and Ernie, what do you think about all this? And what do you think about the notion that, you know, maybe that people a dozen years ago didn't foresee something like Google being such a part of their business information retrieval process, but now it's so integral they can't survive without it. Do you think that this stands a chance of really usurping the way that case law is accessed and used in our country?
I think those are the access versus use question is two different, importantly different questions. I think access is tremendously valuable, and I applaud this, and I applaud things like the publicresource.org efforts and Carl Malamud's work and a number of other organizations that are doing what they can to put case law and statutory law in the hands of the public. I mean, what could be more public content than the laws under which our country is governed? So for that, and the pure data of it and all of that, I think it's fantastic. How it's used the use could be, it's an expansive audience of different potential uses, from journalists and researchers to general public, just trying to understand what goes on mysteriously in our courthouses, to, you know, what lawyers actually do when they're practicing. And as a lawyer, I may start some of my searches there and then figure out kind of what I think is the direction I want to go, and then go into a more expensive service to really do the meat of the search and to have confidence that I've captured all the relevant, you know, cited cases or history and whatnot. I really would be uncomfortable relying on just what's out there on public websites if I'm looking for a complicated opinion or I'm trying to make a recommendation on a matter. And also, if I'm citing things to the court, the last thing I want to do is be embarrassed and embarrass my client by citing a case that was overturned 3 weeks ago and I didn't hear about it or something like that. So I think there's different uses, and depending on what the use is, I think you're going to see different services being responsible or the best place to go for various information. But I think it's phenomenally important that this information is in the public's hands and freely available, if possible.
Ernie, what are your thoughts?
I totally agree. I think that, I mean, you know, back in the old pioneer days when, you know, it was you, me, and Rick and Rory Perry, we used to have debates about this, or not debates, we would talk about the law needs to be free. I mean, it just seemed bizarre to me that back in 2002, I could just kind of accidentally start using this internet tool and broadcast and learn how to use HTML or not really have to learn much. And then I'm blasting all this information. I was like, well, why is the government not supplying the same information? They have it. You know, if they would just give it to somebody who knew what they were doing, who was slightly motivated, they could publish all these opinions. And you know, since then, you know, there, a lot of things have developed. You know, yes, Westlaw and Lexis, you know, are the predominant purveyors of this sort of information. And lawyers aren't going to drop their Westlaw account, obviously, not anytime soon because of this. But I've been using a service called FastCase, which the Louisiana Bar Association provides for free to its members. And, you know, FastCase I also would not rely on completely, but it's a good place to start. What I like about Google Scholar is that now I can hyperlink directly to an opinion and know that if somebody clicks on the link, they're going to go right to that opinion. That is huge. I mean, that is the law, the case law finally is available in a way that you cite to other authorities. I mean, for a bunch of years now, I've been citing to things on the web by using a hyperlink. And really, all a citation is a hyperlink that you have to manually execute by going to the book to find the information. And of course, you have to do all the other things and analyze. But when it comes to the act of purely going to that case to see what it says, to make it easy for the person that you want, you know, to access that case, you know, we can now do that. That's huge. To me, that is just phenomenal.
Yeah, I can hear court reporters quaking in their boots across the country as we have this discussion, because a huge part of my practice over the years has been in the appellate courts. And, you know, we put together these electronic records and submit e-briefs to the court that are full of cases that are cited in the briefs and hyperlinked, but they're not hyperlinked to the web. They're hyperlinked to CD-ROMs in, you know, as though those things were still used in any other context, they are used for that purpose. And, you know, it's nice in one sense because it's offline and, you know, you don't have to worry about access to the internet or speed or quality of connection or whatever. The judge can take that stuff with him or her and be able to click through the brief and get to the references. But I think we're getting to the point where people's internet connections are reliable enough and even the judges of our world are online enough in a consistent way that having a brief that linked to Google citations on the web would be an awfully nice thing. So I definitely think that's something worth looking into and looking forward to maybe.
You know, it's funny, just as you were talking right now, I had just done some research the other day and I decided to use Google Scholar to do the research because I can go to the Fifth Circuit Library, which is right next to my building, and they have free Wi-Fi and, of course, they have free Lexis too, but I don't want to sit over by the Lexis terminal. I want to sit by the books. So I sit by the books, I type into Google Docs, and I create hyperlinks, you know, look up the cases and create hyperlinks. And just now, using my iPhone, I accessed the Google Docs, took like 2 seconds. I click on the link to the case and I'm reading the case. I mean, on my iPhone, this is huge. And it's because it's not behind a registration wall or a paywall.
And it's not a heavy, big document. It's not a PDF or something that your iPhone needs to... I mean, mine takes forever to open because I'm still on the old one. But but the gist is that, yeah, it's very technologically accessible from all sorts of devices, the way it's set up.
That makes me very happy to hear that. It hadn't even occurred to me when this was still in pre-launch mode to check what the interface was on my iPhone. And then it was only when I saw somebody's blog post a couple of days ago talking about the fact that they can go on their iPhone in the browser, go to scholar.google.com, punch in a query, and then read the full text of the case right there in front of them. And I was thrilled at how usable it was. I mean, we have some smart engineers here. The guys who built this really, I think, delivered just a wonderful experience. And I'm very encouraged to hear you explain that workflow, Ernie, because it certainly echoes our hope that by making these tools very lightweight, it makes it much easier for people to actually get something productive done. So that's a great way for me to sort of bookend this whole process, is to hear somebody who's already used it in a real example.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
I have a quick question. What's going on in the last? I know there's been stuff recently, as last summer, but what's been going on more recently with access to statutory law? I think publicresource.org was having some difficulties in Oregon, and I'm wondering if the statutes are part of Legal Scholar or planning to be, or Google Scholar, or what's going on there? Do you know,
yeah,
Rick?
Yeah, statutes are not part of the collection today. We certainly would love to have more content in Scholar. We're always looking for new collections of content to add. It's fun for me. My background in this space started with the law review that I started at University of Richmond, the Journal of Law and Technology, which was the first in the world to publish only online. And it's fun that I can go to Scholar and search against all of those articles that have been written over the last 15 years, which starts to make me sound very old. but as far as statutes go, I do recall there was some issue in Oregon with what Carl was doing at public.resource.org. I've chatted quite a bit with Carl over the last few days. I'm happy to report that Google will be supporting his law.gov initiative. So along with Tim O'Reilly and Tim Stanley at Justia, and a number of other organizations, Google will be supportive of law.gov. It would be wonderful to see both the federal government commit to a standard mechanism for getting primary materials online. And I think to the extent that information is easily accessible online, then that makes it that much easier for us to index it and make it searchable. It would be wonderful if we didn't need to go manually acquire this content, but could simply go to a site and crawl it and then add it to the index like we do for much of the rest of the web. So we're very supportive of those efforts. We would like to see Carl's initiative specifically be successful. And I know that there are a number of people in government who are looking at this and trying to think of ways to make both at the federal level and then at the state levels, those processes much more transparent. So nothing to report right now, but I'd like to think that over the next months, we will see more efforts produce tangible results, which would make the collection of content in Scholar much more comprehensive.
Well, great. We had a comment from our Facebook page, which people can access at denise.howell.net/FB. Michael Sardina says, judging from Ernie's comments, Ray Google Scholar, I take it this is a service he will potentially use in his practice. As a law student, being somewhat unfamiliar with best/accepted practices, I was wondering whether it is appropriate for an attorney, large firm, small firm, solo practitioner to utilize the service. Could a practicing attorney rely solely on Google Scholar? What about slip opinions or cases that are so recent as to have the Westlaw or Lexis citations only? Is doing a search for case law through Google Scholar sufficient/adequate, or could an attorney possibly face a possible legal malpractice claim for not using Westlaw or Lexis, e.g. not shepherdizing a case? Well, I think we've covered a lot of that, that indeed Google and Rick and the team that worked on this are not intending this to be a replacement research tool for attorneys. And yes, we have our obligations to make sure that everything is current and site-checked correctly and shepherdized correctly, and that this is a wonderful supplemental tool, but is not the be-all, end-all standard of legal citation and practice. You guys agree?
I mean, I think what Colette said is probably as far as I would suggest a practitioner go, which is it might be a decent place to start. I don't think it's going to be where you end. And that ultimately depends from a practitioner's point of view of what else needs to be done. And certainly if there's recent developments in the last few weeks, we're going to constantly be working to make our collection as current as possible. But this is a new part of Scholar, and so I think it's going to be a while before we know exactly how quickly that turnaround is. It's nice that in the main web index, often within 90 to 120 seconds of my blog post going live, it will be indexed in Google search. But we're not suggesting right now that in Scholar, within 1 to 2 minutes of an opinion hitting the web, it will be available in Scholar. So I think, Denise, your sort of summary of that and Colette's suggestion, I think, is probably exactly the right answer.
Yes, someone in the wave, actually, and I should mention that we do have multiple chats going. If you're listening live, you can get to the wave at denise.howell.net/wave39. There's also a French feed chat at denise.howell.net/twill39. And of course, our standby, always reliable and interesting IRC chat, irc.twit.tv. Anyway, over in the wave, let's see, I just clicked away from it. It was Chad.
I want to know where Chad, the gopher site for Twill is.
The gopher site.
You got everything else.
Yeah, we've
set
got
up.
Everything else, exactly. Chad was wondering how often the database is updated, and I think you said as soon as something hits the web, it'll get crawled and go in there. Is that right?
That's certainly the intention, and I think we're still working things out. We're going to let the dust settle on the initial collection. We're still making some tweaks here and there. Our goal certainly is to make it as current as possible and include new opinions as they're published.
Rick,
but I think that'll take us a while to sort out exactly what those mechanisms are and how reliable the processes we have in place right now are for including new content in the collection.
So does the collection currently include, or will it at some point, the briefing that accompanies some of these opinions? Or like how, I know that there's, you know, the new, there's all, a lot of stuff is available through Pacer, and there's that new Firefox plugin that makes it, I forget what it's called right now, but it allows you to kind of see other
recap.
People's briefs. That's right. Recap the law. But I'm curious if there's briefing being pulled into any of these, or right now it's focused on decisional law.
There are no briefs in the collection today. The current focus is opinions primarily, and make that for the case law portion of what Google Scholar has. Today, the goal is have it be as comprehensive a collection of opinions as it can be.
And you've got law journals in there as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how those are being put in?
Yeah, so there are law reviews, law journals. I mentioned Journal of Law and Technology, my baby from way back, and many, many others. It should also be noted that when you're looking at an opinion, there really are three portions of the site or of the page when it says how cited. You'll see how other opinions have cited the case that you're reading. You'll also see documents that reference the opinion. And we use the word documents not because it's just a synonym for opinions. It's because it's not just other opinions. It's also law review articles that cite to this case. So it's a nice way of pivoting out of case law and going to secondary research that talks about it. We also have this thing called Google Books, which has been the subject of much attention on This Week in Law over the last couple of months. And there are a number of books in the Google Books collection that if they talk about an opinion, we will surface those as well. And depending on how much of that book is available, if any, for browsing, you'll be able to pivot out of Scholar and go into the books interface and actually see the pages in the book that talk about that opinion. So I think what we're trying to do here is we're trying to build a useful service, and we have a lot of these pockets of content that exist across a number of services that, in my experience, as I've talked to professionals and give presentations both inside of Google to executives and so forth who are visiting Google and at conferences, a lot of tools that Google has built that users simply don't know about. And it's been fun. Google Scholar has been out for years. But in many cases, over the last few days, it was people's first interaction with it because they didn't realize, A, it existed, or B, it had material that was relevant to them. So it's fun to be able to use one of these to expose users to the breadth of content that we have across Google and then try and stitch it together in a way that makes it useful.
Yeah, that was certainly true of me.
In that vein, Rick, I noticed that you have the site has a Give Site Google Scholar badge or a code that you can plug into your website so that somebody can put on, for example, I could put on my blog a little thing that says Search Google Scholar, and that's great. I would do that, except I don't really want to put a badge that says Search Google Scholar. What I want to do is put a badge that says Search Google Scholar Legal.
Interesting. So I'm going to go to the Scholar website and see what you're talking about, because I'm not even sure I know what that's referencing.
Yeah, it's like give your site the power of Google Scholar, and then it says you can enter your email address, and it gives you kind of those little badges, like the search badge that you would put for Google if you put just a Google search badge on your site.
Oh, I see what you're talking about. So boy, that would actually be really easy. So I can talk to the engineers.
Because I would put one of those on my site in a heartbeat, and I think a lot of lawyers would too, just because it's kind of a way of saying, hey, here's the law for free if you want to search it, and
Right. It would just be a matter of shortcutting the advanced search, right?
Yep.
Right, Rick?
We're taking you to the advanced search, actually.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things you could do. One would be simply modifying the query that gets kicked off of filling out the form so that it knows to be restricted to the collection of legal opinions and journals.
Yeah,
the second would be actually taking you directly to the advanced search, both of which are doable, and that's a great idea. So I'll once we hang up here, I'll relay that to the engineers. I would imagine they would love that.
Cool.
And the only other recommendation I have is that somewhere you explained the date restrictions or the how much inclusion there was. I had trouble figuring that out, and then you DM'd me, and we talked about that. And then I read that other people had read articles, but I couldn't see that from the Google site. Now that's something that I think scholars, especially legal scholars, would want some description. Of course, if it changes, then you could modify it. But there's some page that you go to where you see, I see what the scope of this is.
So I think shortly after we noticed that other people were asking about that, there is a small paragraph that's added to the About Google Scholar or the help page, which now explains which court opinions do you include is the question. And it tells you now state appellate and Supreme Court cases since 1950, U.S. federal district appellate tax and bankruptcy court since 1923, and U.S. Supreme Court's cases since 1791. Please check back periodically for updates to coverage information. So we will update in here that section, and I think try and make it clear to the extent that if I get the CD-ROM copies of the tape backups of the Virginia Supreme Court opinions, as promised by my former law professor, that we may start providing more granularity there as we are able to incorporate more content.
Cool.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Rick, for bringing us up to speed on this. And this is definitely our resource of the week for This Week in Law. Google Scholar Legal, which I tend to say, or write with a capital L, but is really just a subset of Google Scholar, which has a lot more information. And I agree, it's nice to have it surfaced and talked about again because it's been around for a while. So thank you, Rick, for all your hard work on that and the whole Google team.
Oh, my pleasure. I'll take that on behalf of the team. I had somebody else try and lay this all at my feet, and I can claim credit only for being involved. It's the work of a number of people, and it's actually been fun to reach out to people who have left Google, who at various times were involved in the project. So people like AMAC, Alex McGilvery, who's now Twitter's general counsel. He'd been very involved in this a while back when he was at Google. And Katie Stanton, who now works in the White House, who emailed me from China. She was on the trip with the president on Tuesday, and it was fun to get an email from her. She was very early involved in this project. So it's been fun to sort of share that with people who had been involved and now have moved on to other things. And there's a ton of people inside of Google who get a lot of credit for making this happen. But happy to take credit on their behalf and then share it with them when we hang up.
So did you take any flack for putting it out on your Twitter page before it actually went up on the Google blog?
You know, I think I begged for forgiveness after the fact. I said, I've known about this thing for 2 years and I've kept the damn secret for so long. I could not contain it any longer. And it was officially live. So I didn't really say what it was. I just there was just a link to Scholar.
Cryptic.
And then just said, you know, if you can figure out why this is a big deal, then more power to you. It was actually really fun to watch the word spread, you know, because Tim Stanley retweeted it, then Carl Malamud retweeted it. And after about five people who were really close to this space and very quickly figured out what it meant, it just started expanding like wildfire. So it was that was fun. And no one has yelled at me. So I'm hoping that as of now, Friday at noon, I've gotten away with it.
Okay, well, I'll just have to give you flack for not actually breaking the story here on Twill. I thought we were getting the exclusive, but I'm glad that we've gotten a good amount of time talking with you about it. That's awesome.
Glad to have been here. Fun to share it with you guys.
All right, so let's move on to some other stories and links and tips. Ernie, you had just popped up with what could be one of our tips of the week. I have another one a little bit later from one of our other stories, but why don't we get to the one that you saved for me in Delicious about tipping.
The mandatory gratuity, yeah. I was surprised. Apparently, I saw somebody tweeted out about a controversy on Yelp, and it was apparently a restaurant that was taking a lot of heat on their site because they had, if I got this right, I mean, I kind of read it quickly, so I'm not sure exactly what it was all about because I quickly went off on a tangent of looking at this link. But it was apparently these a large party of eight people or six people or whatever, and there was a mandatory gratuity added. But what they did was they paid somehow, and I don't know how you would do this, but they wrote on their credit card the amount for the meal but not the tip. And then left. And so the restaurant had them arrested. And I don't know where that incident occurred, but somebody linked to a New York Times article where a prosecutor dismissed a case, a similar case, because they held that the law is that a mandatory gratuity is a tip and not something that you have to pay. So I guess it's not really a mandatory gratuity then.
Wait, I'm lost. So
in other words, if you go to a restaurant and it says, oh, a party of six, you must pay 15%, and you don't, and you pay nothing because you don't want to tip at all, they can't enforce that. They can't force you to pay a tip.
Right. So at least you can't.
The article was from 2004, I think, and in New York. So at least in New York, it appears that's the law.
You need to shepherdize it then, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, somebody get on Google Scholar and see if it's been updated.
So there's our recession-oriented tip. If a restaurant is trying to stick you with that extra 15 or 20% for your large party, that, you know, if you're feeling like a real bum that day, I guess you can walk out, at least in the state of New York, and not fear arrest or legal ramifications.
And since I was a waiter,
it's kind of extreme that they got arrested for it. I don't know what broke down there in the communication, but it's just
seems like they just get beat up or something.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was some backstory that we don't know about that makes it all, you know, pieced together. But you know, I guess the point is, you know, a tip is a tip, and the word tip, as I, you know, being a waiter, I remember this, stands for to ensure promptness. So it's really not something that you are required to pay. The point is you pay it, you know, with the idea of enticing, you know, better service. So if you get bad service, why should you have to pay a mandatory gratuity?
Yeah. All right. Well, since we're doing tips and resources, I have one more tip, and it ties to one of our stories in our link list. And the link list for the shows is always at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/episode of the show. So today we're episode 39. This was on TechCrunch, and it's, you know, I just love when demand letters that are completely specious or close to it make their way onto the web and get subject to ridicule. And this is one of them. This one involved tweet photo. And this is a story that got posted by Mike Arrington. And just as a funny aside, at least I found it funny, he's just ripping into the lawyers who wrote this demand letter on TweetPhoto's behalf. And they're his former colleagues at Wilson Sonsini long ago when Mike used to practice. That was his firm. So he's managed to put their work out there for public ridicule, and I'm happy to pile on to that. And what it involved was an on-the-record podcast interview by the CEO of TweetPhoto where he apparently said things that, upon further reflection, the company did not want to get out there. So the podcast is out and available, and it was on the record, and you know there was no sense that the person was not authorized. But the demand letter goes ahead and asks for that to be pulled down and says it's a violation of laws prohibiting unfair competition, defamation, as well as tortious interference with contractual relations and prospective economic advantage. All those words we lawyers like to throw out there. So the podcaster, you know, not knowing what to do in response to this and probably just wanting to accommodate the fact that their interviewee no longer wanted the podcast out there, did take it down, but it was still up on iTunes. And Mike Arrington's point is, you know, there's no reason why this shouldn't be out there. It was on the record, and it's something that you're just going to have to live with, TweetPhoto. And he says he's listened to the whole thing, and there's not much in there that he'd say was interesting or sensitive. I myself have not listened to it, but I do think it's funny that the effect of the demand letter is to give more exposure to the interview itself, which probably would have been a lot more obscure, but for this exposure. Colette, you're the author of the podcasting legal guide up at Creative Commons. Do you have any thoughts on this particular episode?
Yeah, so I've read the article you sent in the cease and desist letter, but I too haven't listened to the podcast. But it sounds like the podcaster had permission, you know, an on-the-record interview. And, you know, I hope, you know, my best practice recommendation is to get something like that in writing. You know, like, you're coming on my show, I have the right to publish what we discuss. And, you know, also for right of publicity issues, the CEO, you know, you want that person's permission. But regardless of that, you know, journalists have, there's of course the background debate, you know, are bloggers and podcasters journalists, but I think that's an arbitrary line. And I think in this case, this party sounds like he was doing really traditional journalism stuff, you know, interviewing somebody on the record with the microphone. And I'm not sure if it was video. It looks like it was video, actually. You know, yeah, I think he can publish that. And if they want to claim trade secret violation, well, that's a problem between them and the CEO, in my view. And having not seen it, I can't really say if he does anything specific in the interview that encourages the just, you know, distribution of stuff that should be trade secret or confidential in some way. I just don't know, and I can't really say. But I going to the point that you're making, Denise, that this is, you know, sending these kinds of letters, and Wilson knows this. I mean, their lawyers know this market, and if you send a overbroad cease and desist letter, you have to be ready for the posting of that letter and potential criticism about
and that's
that.
That's the tip I wanted to associate with this story, is that if you're a lawyer and you're sending a demand letter or a cease and desist letter, you better darn well make sure you're on solid legal ground and that they're, that it's going to be public, that there's going to be scrutiny, and you better feel good about that.
This is just, Mike Masnick coined the term the Streisand effect, right?
Absolutely.
And this is the perfect example of it, and we see it again and again and again, and I would hope you're right, Denise, that the lawyers at Wilson who executed the letter on behalf of the client would understand this. This is one of those that I'm never going to be on the practicing lawyer side of this. I got my degree, but I do not practice, will never practice. I'll always be the client in this case. And I would hope my lawyer would do everything but put a gun to my head to prevent me from being stupid and issuing this kind of demand that A, calls attention to the very thing that I'm claiming I don't want attention called to, and then leads someone like Mike Arrington to say, hey, if this gets taken down, if the podcaster actually respects the cease and desist, then I'm just going to put another copy up. And I get a hell of a lot more traffic to my site than the podcaster did. And it's going to be seen by orders of magnitude more people than ever would have seen it otherwise. And this just feels like one of those cases where, look, I get that somebody got angry about something, whether or not it had anything to do with what was actually said in this interview, or it's just more of an issue between the CEO and the board, whatever. But there are better ways of having this happen. Call the podcaster, explain the situation, and say, hey, we've got a problem. Is this something you can help us with? And now that podcaster is given an opportunity to potentially decide that the benefit of helping the company is better than the benefit of continuing to put this podcast out. He might take it down just because, and knows that somebody owes him a favor now. And that would be a much better mechanism of accomplishing what you want than this blitz approach of we're going to swing the hammer of a cease and desist and threat of litigation on what appears to me to be, at least based on the facts I know, to be a pretty shaky claim.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it highlights the second part of the tip I wanted to give around this story, which is if you find yourself in receipt of a letter like this, there is a website out there, chillingeffects.org, that is designed to give the light of day and exposure and commentary on cease and desist letters and consider whether they are well-founded or not, and to somewhat deflate the chilling effect they can have on people's conduct. But I think in this situation, it's underscoring how the web itself is a chilling effect on the sending of this kind of letter at all. And, you know, I think as we move forward, there's still, you know, a generation of lawyers out there who have grown up that this is the way you commence a legal dispute. But I think that generation is slowly getting older and taking their medicine on these things, and that we may well see a change in the way that law is practiced and much more along the lines of what you just described, Rick. You guys agree?
And there's another, I think what Rick mentioned about thinking about other ways to accomplish the goal, which is that this document or this interview in this case does not get widely spread. And sending the letter from giant, massive Silicon Valley law firm on behalf of the company is not step one in my experience. You know, a call is a good idea from the non-lawyer even. Have Caulfield call the guy. Say, hey, I screwed up in this interview and I really want to talk to you about it. Sometimes I help the client with drafting a letter when they have an issue so that they can directly send it. It's between the company or the two parties themselves, and then they can escalate it to outside counsel if they feel like it ends up needing to have that kind of impact. But it seems a little like smashing a bug, if you want to call it, with a ginormous mallet when, you know, it It doesn't need to be done that way. The other lesson, and I, this letter doesn't have this problem necessarily, but it's something that comes up with whenever you send a cease and desist. Let me do that.
Stereo and round out there.
Yeah. I don't know what I hit. Let me fix that. Hold on.
Okay. Put yourself on mute. Ernie, do you have any thoughts on this before we...
Yeah, no, I agree with Colette. I mean, I think that, but I think the problem stems from the, if all you have is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. And for lawyers, you know, who work at big firms, they see these kind of problems and say, let us, you know, load the big cannons and do the big cannon thing because that's what big firms do, as opposed to saying, there's a problem here. Let's look at the problem before we look at the legal problem, because maybe we can make the problem go away without applying the law. But you know, lawyers don't think that way. And you often hear lawyers say, well, I'm not here to give my clients business advice. I'm just here to give them the law. Let them make the business decision. And I don't think that's a cop-out. You know, as a lawyer, you're a trusted advisor. And if you know that common sense dictates a certain course of action, then telling your client that they should do something that defies common sense, you know, and then say, well, it's up to the client to exercise common sense. That's a total cop-out. I don't buy that. But I think that that's the root of the problem.
Yeah, I totally agree. I have a story that say something else.
Wanted to wrap up. I totally agree. And I apologize for the little glitch. The point I wanted to make is whenever you send a cease and desist letter, you have to be really careful not to incite a lawsuit against you. You have to, it's called declaratory judgment jurisdiction. And this happened not too long ago for a pro bono client of ours, where she was a blogger and had some comments on her site that this party was really upset about. And in addition, was upset about some of the posts, but it was, we think, First Amendment protected. But the letter was sent was basically, all this stuff is horrible and bad and you're going to be liable for 25 million things. And at the end it says, we will sue you if you don't remove these posts. Hmm. That kind of a letter says to the blogger, well, you know what? If you feel like finding pro bono counsel or finding a lawyer, and you can go to court and file that lawsuit, and then they're in the defensive. And I think it's just really risky sometimes. And we really shocked, I think, that party when we did file the lawsuit, because they learned their lesson. They had new counsel very shortly thereafter. But it was... you know, it's just really, you have to be careful with these cease and desist letters, not only for the publicity issue and the Barbara Streisand effect, and there's the practical sense of this stuff on the web, but also, you know, the legal things that it will trigger.
Absolutely. So there is a great story about, we are constantly hearing stories about social media gaffes getting people in trouble. I was pleased to see this week a story about something on a social media site actually exonerating someone from robbery charges and getting them dropped. But before we get to that, I want to go ahead and take a break and thank our new sponsor, Ford Sync. I have a friend who is a Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury dealer, and I'm definitely going to be in touch with him soon because I am so prone to being in my car and trying to navigate between how to get the music on properly, making calls. You know, you get a text and you're driving along going, you know I can't text and drive, but this looks urgent. And you know, my son's in the backseat, and definitely that adds to my hesitance to ever take my eyes off the road. But Sync My Ride, all hands-free, can enable you to get all that stuff done and keep your eyes on the road. You can go to Sync My Ride podcast and get all the information there. There's music and podcast search and turn-by-turn navigation. There is obviously making and receiving calls hands-free on your phone. There is access to real-time traffic and weather. Also, when you go to Sync My Ride podcast, you can enter to win a free Nano or Zune by sending a tweet with the hashtag #SyncMyRidePodcast. And you can find all the further details of that at SyncMyRidePodcast.com. I think this is a great service, definitely something that we need in today's mobile world, where I think it was something like 18 states and counting have laws against using your cell phone without some sort of hands-free capability while you drive, and certainly against texting and other distracting things while you're driving. So check it out. Thank you, Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury, for coming up with this much-needed service. And thanks for sponsoring the show. So did you guys see that a teen who was posting his status to Facebook made an update at the time he was accused of committing a crime? And it actually wound up getting the charges dropped.
Yes, amazing.
Amazing. Turned out to be his get-out-of-jail-free card, writes Ars Technica. 19-year-old Brooklyn resident arrested last month for allegedly robbing a man at gunpoint. But the defense lawyer discovered that he had updated his Facebook profile at the time of the robbery. And when he made that known to the prosecutor, the charges were dropped. So hooray for Facebook for finally having a way of exonerating someone rather than simply getting them in trouble for, I don't know, leaking out corporate secrets, things like that. I guess that's another good reason to constantly update your status so that you have an alibi ready and at hand. Although I guess you could start doctoring them up if need be. If you were
right, I kind of got that devious from Ars Technica, that they were suggesting that maybe that they needed to probe more into the level of sophistication of the people using it, and that the judges kind of tended to accept this without understanding that somebody could give their passwords. Of course, obviously, you could maneuver and manipulate it, but I mean, at least the guy had something that could corroborate what he was saying, and in this case, it apparently, turned the day for him. It was great. And you're right. Most of the Facebook stories are something went horribly wrong, and something that wasn't supposed to be posted got posted and got more in trouble than they expected.
Right. The only downside here I can see is you'd potentially have to friend the prosecutor in order to make that data public, which I don't know if that's necessarily what people want to be doing.
I could see that as part of the plea bargain agreement.
Exactly. So I thought that was pretty funny. Also Facebook related, did you guys see that Chris Kelly, the now on leave chief privacy officer, head of global public policy, often a speaker on privacy issues, really interesting and intelligent guy, is running for attorney general of the state of California. And you can find his campaign site at kelly210.com. But the one thing I thought was hysterical, I mean, it's a great campaign site. It's very interactive. It has social media adjuncts. But do you guys notice anything strange about this site?
It's a very curious hue of blue.
Very curious. And font.
And interesting tabs and fonts.
Yes. It looks just like Chris Kelly's Facebook page. a campaign page brought to you by Facebook, perhaps. It definitely looks
perhaps.
Like
it is interesting. I don't know. I might think I don't know how much. I mean, he probably has made the calculation. It helps him tremendously to have his Facebook background to be a big deal, a big aspect of what he brings to becoming an attorney general. I'm not a political campaign strategist at all. So I have not the first idea what really goes behind these decisions, other than to say, you think he'd want to differentiate himself from his most recent employment and show that there's more to him than just the privacy and technology guy. Because that, to me, in a state the size of California, is a tiny thing. I mean, it has a lot of money, maybe, and that's what you need to win a campaign. But maybe he wants to break a little bit more away from that so he can have a broader appeal. That's my only thought.
He's going to use the whole building a safer and more trusted online experience as part of his, I know about how to keep the children safe from online, demons and so forth. So maybe that's his pitch.
Yeah.
If it had been a defense contractor, I don't think that his site would emulate the look and feel quite the extent that it does here.
Yeah.
All right. So, right along. Also interesting, I thought, and I'm wondering what you guys think this means from a privacy and legal standpoint. I love watching the CBS Sunday morning program. I try and catch that each week. And there was a great story they did called The App Revolution Will Be Mobilized, all about iPhone and Droid and other applications, Palm Pre, etc. And one stat jumped out at me from that story, and that is... And I don't know if this is coming from CBS News or what study they are citing, but they're projecting the mobile phone, smartphone application industry becoming a $4.2 billion industry by 2013. And that makes me think a lot about geolocation and how that's coming into play and people being able to find you anytime, anywhere, and what you can do with all that. And whether our laws are ready to handle the boom in mobile applications that can basically connect you to the rest of the world from wherever you are at all times. Ernie, you have any thoughts on that one?
Actually, I do. I have some great thoughts. Have you guys been playing with Foursquare at all?
Yeah. I haven't. I see that it's definitely spreading like wildfire, but I have not jumped in.
Oh, okay. You have to jump in because and it's obviously going to be a time waster initially, but Foursquare is really interesting because what it does is, in addition to providing the usual geolocation features that you would want, like show me if my friends are near me, it sort of accelerates the process by creating a game around all of this. So you get points when you check into new locations, or if you check into a certain place on two separate occasions, or if you check in more than somebody else and you've checked in at least twice, you become the mayor. So, I can't be the mayor of anywhere because I'm really late to the game. So like the burger place that I go to, no chance of becoming the mayor there. But I have embarked on a quest to become the mayor of various courts, like the Fifth Circuit Court, because I know that very few attorneys are playing this game. And so, that's the fun part, and it's funny, ha ha ha. But, think about it. What if if attorneys were using Foursquare, and if I go to court, I'm in one part of the building, but I don't know that a lawyer that I really would like to talk to face-to-face with is in the building. And what Foursquare will show you, and I'm sure all these things do, is like, here are all the people that you're connected to who are in the same place that you are. I think that's actually really cool. Now, I realize that's a really far-out case right now because lawyers aren't going to be using Foursquare. But, maybe if they changed it, to judge, you can become the judge of a place or, something that would appeal to lawyers, maybe they would do it. But it is fun. It is, and it shows you what's possible. And I think that for sure we've just begun to scratch the surface.
Yeah, I would echo, this is a service it launched at South by Southwest in March, and the guys behind it are the guys behind Dodgeball, which is a company Google acquired and didn't really do much with, and they eventually got frustrated, left Google. This is their next venture. I think it's really outstanding, and several things I like. Ernie talked about the game notion. This whole idea of, I look at it from the provider's point of view. You want to incent people to really hammer at your app. And this is something we deal with at Blogger all the time, is how do you make people use the product more? There's all these great features, but if people don't know about it and they don't really have an incentive to dig under the hood, they're just going to continue to do the little piece of your app that they find value in now. So Foursquare does a very good job of providing these badges that you unlock as you do more things, as you visit another city, as you go to another place and check in. There are some very funny badges that you unlock. So if you happen to check into a bar or a restaurant with several members of the opposite sex, you've unlocked the Play a Please badge, which I thought was a pretty funny, very lighthearted approach to sort of teasing, but also playing with the users of the app. I'm starting to see businesses get really smart about using it in things like advertising free drinks for whoever the mayor is. So now what are you doing? You're encouraging people to come back to your bar. And it's really great if Ernie was the mayor, but I've unseated him as the mayor. Now Ernie has an incentive to get back and revisit the bar a bunch because then he'll get free drinks. And then there's a really neat site called socialgrate.com, which what they're doing is they're using Foursquare's API and that of some other services as well that provide geolocation data. I think they're also starting to use the Twitter geodata to tell you where the hotspots are by telling you what places people are checking into the most often, what places people are showing up at the most often. There are a lot of interesting things that bubble up when this data is accessible programmatically. So I think the Foursquare team is really onto something. I think it's a neat app. Given the fact that I'm married and have three children, about the only place I have ever hope of being a mayor of is perhaps my house. But it's really cool to see. And I think cell phones outnumber computers. That will only accelerate. So tools that make it take advantage of the capabilities of those devices, I think will be where we see a ton of innovation. I'm certain that lawyers will find many things to be concerned about with the prevalence of such tools. But as the techie and the nerd, I tend to focus on the cool stuff that this enables.
Yeah, and you know, like one of the other things that it does is you can look around, you can provide tips. So you can say, if you go to this bagel shop, you know, get this bagel, it's really good or whatever, you know. And so you can kind of browse from your phone and see around you what are the latest tips for things that are around you. So again, you know, I mean, to draw this back to the law, let's say I'm a lawyer and I just came out of a certain judge's court and he was really angry that day because he just had a bad day. You know, it's kind of like, hey, tip, you know, Judge so-and-so is in a bad mood today. If I was a lawyer coming in, I could say, oh, okay, that's good to know. I mean, there's just a lot of possibility with something like this. And they're being really smart about how they use it, you know, in the way that Rick just explained. I mean, making it an incentive for people to use all of these features and to explore them and to do it in a game way. You know, like, oh, this is fun, you know, and let me see what I can do and let me compete with my friends. And that's really why Foursquare has taken off, because otherwise when people tell me that there was this thing and it could do geolocation, I'm like, well, what do I really care about that? But now all of a sudden I'm obsessed with becoming the mayor of Lucy's retired surfer bar so that I can unseat my friend, you know, Craig, who spends way too much time there.
Yeah, I got to say, I just don't get that.
Believe me, if you started using it, you would.
So let's Denise, off your wars on Facebook. I just, you know, I see this stuff flying around and going, okay.
For me, Foursquare follows the same path that Flickr and Twitter followed for me, which was the first time I heard about them, I couldn't imagine anyone having any interest in Flickr's case making their photos public. Because for me, up until that point, Shutterfly was how you shared pictures, and you only shared them with the people who you knew. And then Flickr came up and with this completely opposite notion of defaulting to public, and that seemed ridiculous to me. Until 6-9 months went by, and then I thought, oh, I get it. This is a way for people to find photos that are interesting to them, and the community builds around people with common interests. And suddenly I saw value in that approach. Twitter seemed completely noisy and useless to me when I first tried it. I ignored it for about 6 months. And then something clicked. And I said, okay, now it makes sense to me. Now I can start building on it. And now I consider it an absolutely critical part of what I do online. Foursquare for me, heard about it at South by Southwest. I was in complete nerd overload at that point, surrounded by thousands of people who were all geeking out on whatever the latest and greatest was. And I thought, no way. This is a toy that's just not going to be of any interest to me. Now it's clicked. Now I can see there's a business model that I think really is very, very sharp. There's a community discovery notion to finding people who frequent the same places you do and giving them names and identities that encourage you to connect. So now you're encouraging social networking around physical places in person, as opposed to around digital places through a keyboard. And that, I think, there's real value there that goes far deeper than just the surface of unlocking the badges. On the game side, I think I'm seeing more and more services use this notion of unlocking or earning or other things that give you capital in the game. Certainly Facebook has maximized that idea. I think there's something there. I think they're going to become a bigger deal over the next year.
Yeah, I agree that it is sort of an adoption and a learning curve, and you have that light bulb over your head moment when it provides some sort of convenience or functionality that you didn't really realize you needed until right then. And I do think that that's how these social mobile apps will evolve. But I do think, too, that they face a huge challenge in managing people's expectations about privacy. And that it's one thing to make a decision to make certain photos public. When you're putting things on Twitter or a blog or your Facebook page, you're making active choices about what's going to go there. If you're just roaming around the world connected to a device that's constantly alerting folks as to your location, and I don't know, that just makes me a little bit more leery of not so much that information getting out from a personal standpoint, but of people understanding that that's what's happening.
So there's actually two different things at play there. On the one hand, Foursquare is always an explicit action. It's always you have to physically decide to check in somewhere. So there's no accidental releasing of information that you're always hanging out at, you know, the adult DVD store. You would need to decide that you were checking in there to share that with your friends. You could be mayor. The flip side, though, is I actually do use, Google has a product called Latitude, which is a component of Maps that allows me to effectively broadcast my location. It's not place specific. It's just using either the GPS in my phone or the triangulated cell phone tower location. And by default, that's going to share within the city notion to friends, and then you can decide to make it more granular. But I had a great example of that where I use Latitude. I've connected to a number of friends at work. I was at a Giants game over the summer and happened to look at Latitude to update my location and discovered that one of the women I worked with was also at the game because her location showed up. Her little icon was right next to mine. And so I sent her a quick text and asked her where in the stadium she was sitting. And it was just a sort of accidental interaction that we wouldn't have had otherwise. We might have discovered days later as we were both talking about being at the game. But I've found it a way of enhancing sort of my interactions. When I've shown up in a new city, I have a little badge on my blog that says where I am. And it'll say I was in Raleigh, North Carolina a couple of weeks ago for a conference. I've been in D.C. and Minneapolis and other places. It's actually really great to hear from people who happen to be there who then drop me a note and say, hey, would you like to meet for a drink? I mean, that's how I originally, Denise, that's how you and I originally met 6 or 7 years ago. Ernie, same with you. We happen to be in the same city at the same time. And for me, this just increases the accidental hit rate of making those connections in real life as opposed to digitally. I do get, however, Denise, you're not alone. I think there are a lot of people who see that as perhaps crossing the line into TMI pretty quickly.
I could just chime in with, I guess, a not very surprising, hopefully, thought is, you know, the privacy aspect of this, Denise, I'm really glad you brought it up. These things are all opt-in, it looks like, at this point. You know, you can decide to do the app and download it and then update as much as you want. I mean, and I just really hope that users are reading the privacy terms of these companies and these applications and paying attention to what that information is going to be used for by whomever it is that's behind it. I think a lot of, certainly the larger companies think about this and have dedicated internal expertise to decide what's the company's goal and what's good for their consumers and their users, what's not going to turn people off. And so a lot of times they collaborate with privacy organizations to try and get them to help vet you know, what they can do, and that's going to not get them, you know, have privacy organizations write horrible articles and blog posts and whatnot about what these things are doing. So I don't want to be like the big naysayer, but if you're a friend of mine on Facebook, I don't have any apps except for Dogbook, which I now think I may not use because I don't really use it much. But those applications in Facebook, for example, are, in my view, still a complete nightmare when it comes to any sort of privacy, because it really depends on what your friends in the game or in the app are doing in a lot of ways. And I think so many people don't understand that and don't understand how the monetization around the data and the information that we're sharing everywhere we go now is. So I just, you know, I get really uncomfortable, and I'll probably play with Foursquare because I'm really intrigued in anything that Ernie's thinking is so cool, I have to check out. but I, you know, I don't really know that I need people to know this stuff. Or if I'm in court, I mean, maybe there's like a 5% chance I'm going to have a fun, helpful interaction that wouldn't have happened because I'm on a different floor than somebody I would like to see. But I don't know. It's hard for me. I'm not at the aha moment with that yet. We'll put it that way.
And I'll just include a quick plug.
Oh, go ahead, Denise. No, you first.
Okay. So let me just include a plug for something we launched about 3 weeks ago. The I don't know if you guys talked about it at all, but the Google privacy dashboard, which shows you all of the products in one place that have data about you and links to the controls to turn them on or off or change the data that's stored on your behalf. And this was something that we felt very strongly about at Google. This is not a blogger thing. This is Google-wide. Started with, I think, 12 or 15 products, and we'll be expanding it over the next several months to show these users exactly the point that Colette's making, which is, I think, people generally don't understand. They don't read the terms and conditions very closely, and we, as a company, want them to. We want them to know exactly what's being done with the information that they've shared. We want them to know what they have shared in case there was something that was inadvertent, and then give them the ability to change it, remove it, disable it, or constrain it so that it's only shared to friends instead of to everyone. I think that's an important thing, and I would hope other companies recognize the importance of that to the same extent. It's a good first step. It's certainly by no means we're not done in that regard, but there's more that can be done.
Walk us through that on a sort of practical step-by-step basis, because I saw the dashboard announcement and didn't realize it had that whole privacy component. I sort of viewed it as more of an offshoot of Google Profiles.
No. So when you go to, and I'm currently logged in, I'm going to a different browser so that I can get what the rest of the world sees instead of my internal view. So when you go to google.com and you're signed in, there's a link to my account. And let me just give it my password since it's asking for that to verify that I'm in fact me. And then under personal settings, you'll see a dashboard link, which is right below security. You click on view data stored with this account, and then it shows me right now, it shows me my Google account total. It has my name, my nickname, and the email addresses associated with it. It also shows me the websites that are authorized to access the account, which is anytime I've used what's called OAuth as a way for external services like, say, Facebook to query my Gmail address book to see which of my friends are on Facebook, it would show me those websites and then give me a manage account and edit personal information. After that is alerts, shows me what my active alerts are and what the most recent alert sent to me was. Shows me all the analytics sites that I'm currently managing. Blogger shows me what my Blogger profile has, how many blogs I have admin access to, the mobile devices that are authorized to post to my Blogger account, then calendar, then checkout, Google contacts, custom search, docs, and on and on. I use a lot of Google products, so I won't bore you with all the details.
So suppose you don't use Google products and you're using this to surface the fact that your Facebook privacy settings are more open than you perhaps want them to be. Does it do that?
No. This is Google only. So this shows you for every Google product which you have interacted with, If we have private data that you have shared with that product, we're showing you what that is and then giving you links to control, either update it, remove it, disable it, augment it. I know in some cases I looked at this and I said, oh, I didn't realize that checkout didn't have my zip code, so that when I'm searching Google product search, it can give me shipping estimates. So I went into Google Checkout and updated my address so that from now on the shipping data is current. And I will get accurate estimates of how much it'll cost for me to get a product from a merchant to my house, because now Checkout knows what my zip code is.
Oh, that's really cool. Thanks for highlighting that one for us and our listeners. One last note on the geolocation mobile app point is I really like the notion of local geolocated back channels. I think they could be really useful. I also think they could be potentially dangerous, or if you really want that judge knowing that you think he's in a bad mood.
Probably not, no.
Ernie thinks I'm grouchy. Well, I just keep coming back to the fact that there's got to be a good way to manage user expectations, and that, you know, I'm hoping for the day when, because let me step back for a second here. The end game of a lot of these mobile social apps is Minority Report, right? Where you walk into the store and it knows everything about you and your purchase history there and everywhere else, and starts putting things in front of you in a very targeted way. I think a lot of these mobile apps want to be able to collect that data and use it in that way. So, Colette, you make the very good point that people need to be aware of that and have control over how their data is used and by whom. So the Google dashboard is a great step for Google, but it seems to me we really need something that is centered on the user, that looks out and tells sites what they may and may not do, rather than vice versa. Which is one of the reasons I always follow along with what Dark Searles is up to at Project VRM, Vendor Relationship Management, and watch that pretty closely, because that seems to be one path toward a solution. Colette, you were going to say something?
Oh, I would really like a user-focused way. And there may be, I care about this issue, but I only have limited time to like focus on it for myself. I, for example, discovered in a recent vanity search of my name on not so far deep into the results I got on the Google page, was a page from a company out of apparently out of Austria. And they had my name, my real physical home address, all sorts of information, all my relationships to my parents who aren't barely online, and just all this information just right there. And they were trying to sell, you know, more information. For $40, you could get a whole background check on me. And that disturbs me. I mean, I'm fairly public. I have a business. I have a business address and other things, but I don't have my personal address anywhere really, or my family relationships anywhere really. And it just creeped me out. So, I mean, that's not to say this guy is falling, but it's like this, the way this information is being used and the way information is being, you know, spread, and the sale of personal information concerns me greatly. And there's a very big international aspect to this. You know, what we decide to say is a best practice or a good rule and becomes a law in the United States or in California doesn't, or Louisiana, Ernie, doesn't, you know, mean that's going to be the case all over the world. And so I just really hope, I mean, nothing bad has ever happened to me so far on this front, so I'm grateful for that. But I really, the cell phone, because there, it's got a GPS in it, it goes in my pocket or my purse, wherever I'm going. If it's automatically being captured and information like that is being stored somewhere, you know, it, I want to be really careful about how that gets out and how that's used and where, you know, where that information ends up. So
Well, it's a generational thing too, because I'm probably the one with the oldest children here, and they're a great laboratory for me. And my youngest daughter, who frequently gets into traffic accidents and has various problems, I like to keep tabs on where she is, and she's got an iPhone, and of course, it has the wonderful feature that I can track her wherever she is. So theoretically, that excuse that we used to use that the car ran out of gas or whatever, those are gone, right? No, because they know how to turn off the privacy settings. They know that if they, they turn the phone off completely, they can't be tracked. They know how to set the Facebook settings in exactly the right way, the way that a concert violinist would tune their violin. We are the ones, and you're right, Colette, so we should be very careful. But the next generation, this will not bother them at all. That's my prediction.
Rick, I think that might be you that we're getting some clackety-clack keyboard noise.
My apologies.
That's okay. We have a lot more stories on privacy and expectations of privacy, judges' emails and when they are being able to be made public, and also Playboy's Lawyer of Love. But before we get to all that, I do want to thank our other sponsor for this show, Audible.com. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you can get your free book, and we like to go ahead and give you a recommendation each week. And I am thrilled to find a new Audible release just came out at the end of October by John Hodgman, More Information Than You Require, 12 hours of listening pleasure from John Hodgman, Ricky Gervais, Ira Glass, Rachel Maddow, Dick Cavett, Paul Rudd, Zach, oh my goodness, Galifianakis. I'm afraid I'm not familiar with Zach's work, but he's
Galifianakis. It's Zach from The Hangover, and
got it. Well,
brother-in-law.
Yes, I just can't wait to download the audio version of this with all these great contributors, of course, by the hysterical John Hodgman. A further compendium of the complete world of knowledge assembled and illumined by John Hodgman, a, quote, famous minor television personality, contains all the half-truths, fake trivia, amazing made-up facts, and Molemanic lore as the paper edition, narrated here almost entirely by resident expert John Hodgman, occasionally interrupted by this veritable extravaganza of illustrious and sometimes presumptuous guests. So, this is our Audible pick for the week. If you are not yet an Audible listener, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, and it can be yours for free. After 14 days, you'll be a member of the Audible Gold Listener Program. And for $14.95 a month, you can have this kind of book or any book that you like from the over 60,000 titles on Audible for your own listening pleasure. And something like this, I think, is just perfectly designed for audio consumption, and also because it's 12 hours long, for any sort of lengthy plane trip or drive that you have in mind over the holidays. So go check out More Information Than You Require. Check out audible.com, and on Twitter, they're audible_com. Thanks very much, Audible, for your support. So let's talk for a minute about judges and their emails, which under most laws in most jurisdictions, if anything is relating to their employment as a judge, then they would be subject to public disclosure under a Freedom of Information Act sort of request. This is a Virginia case that found that even though certain emails were residing on a government server, the court reviewed those emails in camera, it's called, where they look at them and decide whether they're going to be released or not, and decided that, yes, there were some that were subject to disclosure, but some that certainly weren't. The remaining eight email communications were not related to affairs of government, and so the judges were indeed able to keep them from being disclosed. Did this surprise anybody or raise any issues for anyone? Ernie?
Well, I think that this is kind of the overview question that always exists is, you know, does the employer have the right to your email if you're using your personal email account while there, or if you're using their account for your personal stuff? That's one question that you see a lot, you know, and it's, I think this is sort of a derivative of that. And I don't really know, you know, that it should, I guess the difference is you have public figure and the judge is obviously doing things that are sensitive, and you certainly don't want to release that information. So that's, I think, the big concern. I mean, you know, and I guess I would defer to Colette because she has more background in the privacy area than me.
Yeah, actually, I have not read the opinion, so I'm going to put that out there that is in the links, Denise. But as a general matter, there is an interesting issue about how far the reach of the Freedom of Information Act goes. This is a state case, it looks like, from West Virginia. I'm a little more familiar with the federal. I'm certainly not familiar with the Virginia version of it or West Virginia version. But, you know, what constitutes public documents, it sounds like, is the issue in this case. Like, is the judge's personal email account what's happening, you know, and if it's on the court computer and such, you know, I do think there's an argument that this is stuff that should be subject to, the FOIA type open government and, you know, shining the light kind of statutes. But there is sort of a concern, of course, if the judge is doing, you know, business, real business work, so related to his judicial work or her judicial work, through a Yahoo account that's not the government account, that I think is concerning. And if I recall, Sarah Palin had the same problem when she was running, she was under the microscope and running for vice president. There was a lot of government business that she had been conducting through a Yahoo account, apparently. And so there was lots of effort to uncover that. And I think some of it was. I think it's a super interesting issue, but I apologize that I don't, you know, I haven't analyzed this opinion and I don't have anything specific on this case. It does also remind me of something else in our links was the photos of the attorneys at EFF who had just gotten finally some records from the now Obama administration having to do with the lobbying around the immunity bill that was passed for telecom. And the administration, it's my understanding, fought this for a long time because the communications between the administration and the senators or Congress members of Congress that, around that lobbying effort was really fought, you know, is that something subject to Freedom of Information Act? And I think on that question, they basically have won now, which is great. So it is, you know, people fight what constitutes, discoverable data or, you know, communications in these contexts. And I think that people in government need to start, you know, need to think a little more carefully about what's going on with their personal and professional accounts.
Right. In this West Virginia case, it was the opposite of the Sarah Palin problem. Instead of work-related email off the government servers, there was very personal and, in fact, sexually explicit email on the government servers. And it was being sought in connection with a campaign and would have been, of course, exposed for whatever political benefit that could be gained from that. And they did manage to keep those under wraps. So I think that
just lets us all wonder and imagine, well, what was it? And now everyone's imagination can run wild because we don't know. Sometimes, you know, just the truth will be painful for a shorter time than, you know, people's, imaginations.
Right, exactly. Okay, so we've got a couple of anonymity stories to go through. One had to do with someone who lost their job when a newspaper, the Post-Dispatch in St. Louis, outed an anonymous commenter. Rick, did you have a chance to take a look at this one, and did you have any thoughts about it?
I'm looking at it right now. I hadn't looked at it beforehand. As you might imagine, the dust was a little crazy the last couple of days with the Scholar launch. So give me just a sec. I'm going to get it up on my screen here.
Well, I'll give you the fact rundown, because this one I found interesting. There was the vulgar comment and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch's director of social media hunts down the offender of the vulgar comment and outs him. And so then the question is this a threat to confidentiality of sources because somebody at the newspaper is doing this sort of thing? And, you know, there's a bunch of, you know, that could be a setup line to a bunch of different things for me. I mean, director of social media, he makes me think, is that like a social media task force? That's an inside joke. But I mean, I don't think it's so much of a threat in the way that people raise it. That's a good way to make it a story, is to say, well, then the newspapers will lose their, you know, the willingness of people to give them confidential information if this happens. First of all, the newspapers have much bigger problems than that, you know, and I don't think this is where the biggest leak is that they need to plug. The biggest leak they need to plug, you know, can be revealed if you type in the word "newspapers are" into Google and wait and see what Google suggests. So I don't think it's a big threat to the newspapers. I just think it's kind of strange that the social media director would go to these lengths to out a commenter, you know, and he said something bad. That's not good. But I mean, you know, pursuing these people just usually inflames them and causes more trouble. And I would think that the director of social media would know that. But hey, what do I know? I'm a lawyer.
So, you know, I look at this. I remember back during the days of the Dean campaign when I was working with the folks in Burlington on the campaign blog and some of the web stuff. And I remember that trolls in comments were a perennial problem. People would show up and taunt the other commenters and try and bait them into useless, pointless arguments. I've had a number of trolls on my site over the years. Pretty much anybody that has open comments will deal with that. And I remember the commenters on the Dean campaign blog in particular came up with a wonderful mechanism to combat trolls. And it had nothing to do with outing the people who were saying dumb stuff. It was that they collectively pledged to donate $5 or $10 every time a troll showed up in the comment threads. And one of the things the Dean campaign did right very early on was make you could have United Way like thermometers for different campaigns so that you could show, for instance, how many people in my town had raised money for the Dean campaign. So they set up a thermometer that was specific to feeding the trolls. And every time a troll showed up in the comment threads, they would the other commenters would post a link to show how much money trolls had raised for Howard Dean in that week, in that month. And over time, suddenly there was this really negative incentive to troll in the comments because you were actually putting money in the pockets of the campaign to fight back against these other candidates and other parties. So I look at that.
I take it that one wasn't your brilliant idea.
That was not my idea. I was very supportive, however, of that idea. I look at this and wonder whether this was the wisest course of action for the individual, though it does sound like, given how distasteful the comment was, if I were the one responsible for curating a sensible discussion on a site, I would certainly seek to prevent mitigate comments like this being made on a site that I maintained. I don't know that I would actually call the school and have them find out who, using a school computer, was typing these things on my site. But I look at this more from the perspective of, if you want to encourage community And the only people who are incented to speak out in the community are the people who get the most attention by saying the most just extraordinarily poor taste, really inciting anger kind of things, then you're not going to have a community. So I do respect that this person who was trying to protect the integrity of his community, I get the motivation there. I'm not sure this is necessarily the tactic I would have taken, because you also don't want to squelch legitimate dissent in the process. But this doesn't sound like it was legitimate dissent. This sounds like someone who was, A, denigrating women, just first and foremost, and B, really abusing the community aspect of the site. So does the newspaper have an affirmative duty to this person who was saying these things on the blog? I don't believe so at all. I mean, this person, didn't go to great lengths to protect their identity in the process of leaving the comment. The point at which he committed that content to the newspaper site, up to the newspaper what they want to do with that. And unless there's something specific in the terms and conditions that says, under no circumstances will we ever do anything to reveal who you are, I don't see there being any issue there whatsoever.
Colette, do you think that an action like this, where the newspaper's social media director affirmatively got in touch with the anonymous commenter's employer and it wound up getting them fired, do you think that that could be legitimately actionable?
I don't think so. What I don't like about the storyline is the not so much that they contacted the employer to find out what, you know, I think it's a little weird, but I understand the problem faced with this, the trolls and the negative comments and the just totally non sequiturs that some of these sites have to deal with. But what I don't like about this story was the follow-up post about, you know, reporting that he outed this person and got him fired and kind of ha ha ha. And just the tone of that was so not necessary, and it could have just, they didn't have to write a follow-up story. Mm-hmm. You know, I can see contacting the school or whatever. I don't even know if he know that he was contacting a school, or I forget how he figured it out. I did read this the other day.
Yeah, I don't know how he put it
together. He figured out the IP address, and then he got that Whois information, and then it figured out that it belonged to a local school. And so, I mean, maybe there was a story there in sort of what are people doing on work and government in this case potentially, and, you know, not their personal computers, that might be, there might be actually a good story to tell there and maybe use this as an example, but I don't know that the whole thing about I got them fired too was necessary. But yeah, is it actionable? I don't think so. I mean, yeah, you're really not entitled to that kind of privacy if you're going to not use Tor and you're going to, you know, be posting stuff from these sites.
I tend to agree with you, and I guess the object lesson of this story is that it's not just a subpoena that can reveal your personal information, even if you're posting anonymously. Someone on the service provider side can take it upon themselves to go ahead and out you. And then we had one other sort of related story about a judge ruling that a web commenter will be that their identity was revealed after they made quote unquote deeply disturbing comments over someone's teenage child. The mother was a politician. She had just won a seat, and her 15-year-old son was subject to some sort of comments. And she sought to find out the identity of that person and did. So that's one where the judicial process actually came into play. But that's not always the case, I guess, is the lesson of the Post-Dispatch story.
Yeah, well, this is one thing that I find really interesting about these kinds of cases. My experience has been that a lot of times, and this, the the remedy or the goal of the case and the litigation is just to figure out who said it. Sometimes the party doesn't have any interest in really pursuing a litigation against that person. They just, the not knowing who this critic is the goal. And I, it makes me a little nervous that the judicial system is going to be used or flooded potentially with cases like this where somebody sues, then subpoenas, and then maybe drops the suit because now they know and now they have the remedy they want. It kind of, there's something bad that I think could happen if that becomes the norm or the purpose of, you know, filing lawsuits. I think this is sort of a little bit of what happened in that Lekiskus Cohen, I can't remember the model in New York about the skank thing. I think this was sort of that too. She just filed the suit it basically to unveil who this blogger commenter was. And that was her goal. And I have some reservations about that being the only goal and that people are entering into these litigations, you know, with that being the goal rather than, you know, writing, you know, remedying the real harm, you know, to reputation or financial harm or whatever it is. I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah. And I'm glad you did because it allows me to segue by saying, speaking of skinks, sorry, and I intend that only in a humorous and a non-derogatory way. Fun little story about a woman who once wrote the Lawyer of Love advice column for Playboy magazine, attempting to go ahead and cast herself as the Lawyer of Love in other contexts. And Playboy apparently took umbrage to that and went after her and asked that she, I guess they sued her, saying she waived the rights to her Lawyer of Love moniker in her freelance agreement with the magazine. So I'm sorry, Lawyer of Love. It sounds as though, well, she claims in her own suit that Playboy lost the column because, that she lost the column because she turned down sexual advances by a Playboy executive. So I guess that will unfold itself, but I just thought it was sort of humorous that the intellectual property rights to the phrase Lawyer of Love were up for grabs. I don't know that there's a whole lot more to say about that, but I do want to get your guys' opinion on our last story, which ran in CNN under the headline, Can the Law Keep Up with Technology? Where CNN has highlighted I guess five stories that they find particularly good examples of the law and technology coming into conflict with one another. Is this the skank story? Is that the Courtney Love?
No.
Designer? No, that's a different one.
No, Courtney Love, I think her situation was she's being sued because she said something negative about somebody else through her Twitter stream about clothing designs. I mean, I'm looking at the screen, seeing these words. I'm pretty sure that was the dispute. Her derogatory tweets about this clothing designer. The skank case was a model and another woman who was writing a blog post and kind of saying that she was a skank or a whore and other things. And that they claimed that was defamatory. And I think it's a really good argument that in the context, it probably wasn't. But they were able to unveil her anonymity through through a Google subpoena. It turned out it was some woman that she knew in the past and perhaps had an axe to grind. Who knows? But it does. The question about should her anonymity have been revealed was really interesting because the standard is all over the place in the various courts, and there's a case called Dendrite and another case called To the Mart, which really deal with what I would say and argue is sort of the best practice and what plaintiffs' lawyers should really shoot for when they're trying to unveil this information. Because if you do have a legitimate case, you'll be fine under either of those tests. It's the cases where it's truly First Amendment protected speech or, basically that's it. And then there are First Amendment tests that help weed out the I'm just grumpy because you said something, you had a bad opinion of me from truly things that are defamatory and actionable and not protected under the First Amendment.
Right. Yeah. So that case is actually covered in this article a bit further on.
And hey, guys, I hate to jump in here, but the room that I've been camping out in for the last 2 hours, I'm losing it to the next scheduled meeting. So I'm going to have to ring off. But thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun to hang out with you guys today.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us. Folks can and should follow Rick on Twitter at rklau, R-K-L-A-U, because who knows, he may have yet more Google News that comes out there first. So, and also you can find him at his website, tins/rklau.com.
Tins.rklau.com. You got it. And have a great weekend. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
So I guess the point of this CNN article is just they're wanting to hand-wring a bit and talk about whether society can balance accountability with free speech. And if information is so readily available, how do we define what constitutes privacy? Do you guys think that this is just a bit of sensationalism on their part, or are we truly at an impasse here where technology is really posing challenges to our legal system that it has not confronted before? Ernie?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. I say this all the time because it strikes me that if people don't want to comply voluntarily with, you know, ordinary laws, that's a problem. You know, it's one thing if you run a red light, you know, at a crossroads in an Iowa cornfield late at night, but it's another thing if people just decide that on Fifth Avenue, the red light doesn't matter anymore, it's too much trouble, that you know, it's in their way and they're just going to ignore it, and everybody does the same thing. That's not good, because the law, you know, if you have to enforce it with the big stick all the time, then it becomes socially more social friction than social lubricant. And the law really, you know, has a purpose. And the purpose, you know, I always say this jokingly, but I mean, it's like, you know, back when you had tribes, you know, if somebody killed Thag and he was the chief hunter, that's not good. So we created dispute resolution mechanisms so that people wouldn't bop each other over the head with sticks and do things that were socially disruptive. And we've reached a point where this is true. I don't agree with the examples they give. I think the examples they give don't necessarily make the point. But, you know, the point is that the law relies on precedent, and precedent takes a while to develop, and then it takes a while to disseminate the information that, hey, this is what we all agree on. And, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, as we all know, you know, doesn't take a case as soon as there's a split in the circuit, but waits to see if there's an opportune time and to see how things percolate. Well, you know, if important technological developments require the law to respond and to give guidance, then we need to be moving a little faster than we're moving. And our system, you know, has become more overloaded and more out of touch over the years. And I think it's a huge problem. I really do. So there's my speech.
Colette, any closing thoughts on law, technology, and whether the law can keep up?
Yeah, so when it comes to, you know, who gets caught up in these technological gaffes, we'll call them, and unexpectedly publishing something they didn't mean to publish, or getting, you know, captured in one of these snares, you know, I want to just say that this isn't just people who aren't technologically savvy. I mean, some people I know who, and myself, I've goofed up too, you know, where I feel like I play with these toys and I try to understand them and I want to know what's going on. And even people with a very high degree of privacy radars and, you know, kind of paying attention to know stuff about, you know, we have a lot of new media people who weren't journalists or before, and so have to learn about, you know, kind of standards around journalism and such. You know, people still screw up and they still make these mistakes. And so this isn't a problem that's only for the uninformed. I think it's a problem that's true for even people who are very well informed about these things. And I just, that's my thought. I mean, can the law keep up with technology? It's going to have to, but it always will be lagging behind, and we're going to have funny cases and weird situations come out. And I'm a litigator. I think a lot of times litigation is a good tool, but I think most of the time it's a horrible tool to solve a problem like this. So, like the ones highlighted here.
Yep, absolutely. Well, guys, I think this is a good time to wrap it up. Thanks so much for joining us once again on This Week in Law. Colette, really great to have you back on the show.
Thanks. If I could put a quick plug in for Supernova on the 1st, we have a copyright panel. And I think, Denise, you're doing something there too.
Yes. Social media and the workplace.
Yeah. And then on December 7th and 9th, I'm going to be on a panel for the California Bar's IP and the Internet Conference. It's on the 7th in LA and on the 9th in San Francisco. So I think it'll be a really good conference. The lawyers in California would have probably received the mailing this week. So,
yes. And if anyone is interested in going to Supernova, you can still get a discount on your attendance by, I think the priority code is DH Legal, gets you $200 off, something like that. So feel free to go and sign up and join Colette and I and Alex McGilvery, GC of Twitter, and lots of other luminaries at that conference, which is always a great one. Folks can find Colette at vogelaw.com and at vogelaw on Twitter. And we'll look forward to, we're taking next week off, by the way, the day after Thanksgiving. We're going to be digesting our turkey. But both Colette and I will have just come off of Supernova when we record the next show. So hopefully we'll have some good feedback from there. And Ernie, thanks so much for joining us again.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and I look forward to being back next time. But in the meanwhile, everybody have a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks. Yes, absolutely. And folks can find Ernie at ErnieTheAttorney.net and at ErnieAttorney on Twitter. Go follow him and Colette. And if you'd like to follow me, I'm at D Howell. And we really appreciate you tuning in for the show, and we will see you after the Thanksgiving holiday. Take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.